Hi, I'm John Badham. I'll be providing some commentary for you during the course of this film. Our first image is of the Brooklyn Bridge and how it connects back to Brooklyn from Manhattan. That's a key image in this film, as the connection between these two worlds, which are so close together and yet so far apart at the same time. Brooklyn, which is a very nice working class community, versus Manhattan, which is supposed to be the height of sophistication. So we move into this little neighborhood of Bay Ridge. And in the late 1970s, this kind of fashion was it. The high heels and the big bell-bottom pants. So we shot this shot on the sidewalk of 86th Street with the original demo of Staying Alive playing along with Tony, or John Travolta, as he's walking. So that was to keep him in absolute sync with the song and bring a spirit. And you actually find people on the street going along with it. The Bee Gees had done all the demos. This is John Travolta's sister.
Two, give me two, that's good.
I think until I did this film, I'd never heard of this idea that you could stack two pieces of pizza, one on top of the other, and eat it that way. It's a distinctly Brooklyn technique. Some of these shots actually are not of John, but of John's double, Joey, who was there when John couldn't be there, and John had to be out of town because his girlfriend had passed away, and he had to be there, and obviously was in no shape to work. So we did a lot of those shots while he was gone, including this one of the paint can swinging. It was on the first morning of shooting that we started with this shot, and it seemed to be innocent enough. We're on the corner of 86th Street, and he goes in and talks to the shirt owner. But as you see him come out, you'll see there were about 15,000 people there trying to see John Travolta. It was the first indication we had that John was a major undiscovered star. I've never known the name of this woman, but if anybody knows, please send me a self-addressed stamped envelope with the keys to your Florida condo and her name, I'd be much appreciative. And I'm told that she looks exactly the same 25 years later and hasn't changed a bit. It was as we worked on that particular sequence that we discovered the kind of attraction that John had, because it started with a few schoolgirls noticing him, and then became hundreds and then thousands, and by noontime of that day, we had to quit and go home. Here's John Travolta's mother.
Just a minute. Look what I got for you. Carnival.
Where have you been? I've been here for a half hour.
I'm going to make you a deal on this thing.
Here's a woman with two lines of dialogue who got more treatment than Jack Nicholson would get on a movie. I think we sent limousines to New Jersey to pick her up and bring her. And, of course, we're not going to be mean to John's mother. She's very nice anyway.
Customers like that. It gives them a sense of power. I need some brushes.
All right, how much paint are you planning to do?
After these school rooms, I wouldn't paint my wife's ass purple.
What color is it now?
You want to know what color my wife's ass is?
You brung it up?
Actually, it's wonderful that we could actually, you know, work inside a real hardware store in times before this. They would probably have built a set because the equipment was just too big to go in real locations. And though we take that totally for granted now, at this time, being able to function inside real sets was a blessing, because you can imagine what it would have cost to build and dress and put hardware all in a set like this, whereas the actual location and nothing beats. the real thing.
You got money all week. You can save a little. Build a future.
Oh, fuck the future.
No, Tony, you can't fuck the future. The future fucks you. It catches...
Our script is an amazing script by Norman Wexler, where the kind of language that we hear being used is so different from anything that had been heard in movies up to that time. These people were written to talk like real people, the way real people actually talk, with the vulgarities, with the cursing, everything. And of course, this horrified some of the audiences in Hollywood, of the professionals who came to see the movie early on, who just were shocked that we would allow such language and vulgarity into a regular movie. I myself actually got fired the day after this movie came out because one executive was so horrified by the tone of it, and he figured that I was going to make a movie for him that was just as vulgar and just as ugly. He should have been lucky that it would have been just as successful, I suppose. Whereas his picture opened and closed when he made it inside of 3 days. This one's still here to tell the story 25 years later.
Oh, that is beautiful.
You like it?
This young lady is running on a soap opera, Lisa Peluso, now, and has been doing it for quite a while. Now, nobody ever complained when you show girls in wearing bathing suits and things like that in movies. There were more complaints in this movie about that shot of John Travolta, you know, seen from down on the ground looking up at his crotch as though we were leering at him. And got all kinds of hassle from different critics at the time. We were letting some man walk around in his underwear and showing his body off. John worked really hard to keep his weight because he just has got that set of genes that wants to put on weight, and he can just look at food and it starts to expand, and he just works so hard to stay slim and keep his weight under control. There were lots of times we'd get close to lunch and we'd be in a close scene and you'd hear this strange gurgling in the background and realize that it was John's stomach saying, "Feed me, feed me." Notice the special polyester shirts here. All of the wardrobe in this movie, from top to bottom, was bought in the stores. Nothing was made. We wanted to have an exact, authentic wardrobe that people were actually wearing, not to mention which we couldn't afford to make anything. Probably a better and more truthful reason.
Every time you mention Frank Jr., you gotta cross yourself.
He's a priest, ain't he? Father Frank Jr., your brother.
Your mother doesn't have too much to cross yourself about these things.
You're so jealous of Frank Jr.
Oh, shut up, will you? Hey. Where are you? Boom! And a shirt, wash.
I have to say, I've gotten a lot of credit over the years for the staging of this scene with the slapping back and forth, and I have to say that it was in the original script. It was the way Norman Wexler wrote it, and it was a great gift to me because I got all the credit, but he had written it carefully, and it took me about 2.5 minutes to stage the actors and get them doing, and then I could just stand back and get out of their way. They did it very well all by themselves.
Job in hitting me.
All right, no hitting, no slapping at the dinner table. Okay, that's the rule. Hmm? You was the one that's hitting.
You never hit me before. Never. Not in front of kids.
The grandmother on the right was a real wonderful piece of work. She was meant to only have one word of dialogue in the entire movie, which was basta, basta. But she kept writing new scenes for me, and every morning would bring me new scenes between her and John that we were somehow supposed to do. And she was miraculously good at trying to pad her part, working very, very hard at it. Never did understand why we couldn't do them.
Didn't you go already today?
Yeah, confession. I got to go back to pray for something.
For what?
I think we were really, really lucky to have Julie Bavasso, who is the mother here. She was one of the best actresses in New York, and the kind of real, lovely quality and emotional complexity she brings to things is really terrific. Now, here we're shooting, of course, out on the streets of Brooklyn. Where else? And, you know, getting that very real quality of the exterior as opposed to the back lot.
Get back here!
Yes, folks.
Come on, fuckhead!
This particular car was my choice, that they should have this and have it with rusty parts and paint primer on the side and the paint primer on the hoods. But all the Brooklyn guys told me that I really made a mistake here, that it should have been an old Caddy, that they wouldn't be seen dead driving around in this car. But at that point, we owned two of these things, so there was no going back, even though they probably cost, you know, really expensive, like $1,200 a piece or something like that. And the paint primer was probably a couple of dollars, so we were in budget trouble right there.
Get a bigger half of the pot.
Oh.
You want some? No, we ain't dropping nothing.
All of the actors that we're seeing here are part of Travolta's gang. We're very, very new to film, with the exception of Barry Miller, who's driving the car in the blue, plays Bobby C. He'd actually been acting since he was a little kid, 7-8 years old, and I had actually met him at that point. But a lot of the other kids, it was their first professional job, and they were just joining the Screen Actors Guild at that time. John, of course, had been performing for quite a while on Broadway and on television in Welcome Back, Kotter.
Hey, looking sharp, huh? Sharp as you can look without turning into a nigger.
Or a speck.
Speck, speck, would you put your dick in...
I think I hadn't seen this film for quite a long time, and I was horrified to listen to this scene with the racist dialogue and so on. And I can assure you that you'll probably still find it in Brooklyn, people that that talk this way. The racism is not just confined to parts of Mississippi or Alabama, but it seems to be pervasive all over. One of the fun things about disco at that time was that they loved to take existing pieces of music, in this case Beethoven's Fifth Symphony, and make a very popular disco piece called A Fifth of Beethoven. And it just worked great for this entrance into this wonderful disco. We had looked everywhere at every single disco in New York, and there are so many different kinds. There are discos for yuppies, there are lesbian discos, there are gay discos, there are old people discos, every kind of thing you could imagine. And we kept going back and around and looking at all the different kinds, but we kept coming back to this one, the 2001, which was in Brooklyn, and it was, of course, totally appropriate for this kind of story, because that's what these kids could afford to get into. You had to pay probably $10 to get in, and that was pretty hefty right there. And in the other places, you had to pay a lot more, not to mention which you probably had to drive into Manhattan and go to places that you didn't want to be. This disco was much simpler when we went in. The floor is our addition. There was actually, I think that was our most expensive item on the movie. We spent $15,000 on this colored floor. And the company that made it in New York was able to make it as big as you wanted. You just tell them a size and they'd show up and give you the colors that you wanted. In the background, Charles Bailey, the production designer, decided the walls were too plain. So he went out and bought rolls and rolls and rolls of aluminum foil. That's right, just regular old Reynolds wrap. And he rolled them down on the wall. So as you look back there, what you're seeing is Reynolds wrap aluminum covering all the walls with some Christmas tree lights blinking, mostly white ones, just hung right over them to give this kind of glowing thing. And when the disco owner came to see the film dailies one day, he said, "You boys made my place look great."
A good trip.
But there was a huge fight between Charles Bailey, the designer, and Ralph Botta, the cinematographer, over what colors the floor were going to be. And I think Charles Bailey wanted green in the floor, and Ralph Botta said green would make all the actors' faces look green. The green went, and we had the luxury of being able to see the lights everywhere. Usually at a movie, you have to hide all the lights, but this is just the best thing in the world for everybody, because you could see lights if you wanted to see them, because they were part of the environment.
All right. The boogie started to flow. I heard the
body say, the flowing fire. The dancers here are all picked for their dancing ability, but we didn't want anybody that looked like a dancer. And we rehearsed, of course, a lot with John and with Donna Pescow, who he's now dancing with. This is a brother and sister team in the red dress and the gray suit on the left of the screen. And they were just locals in Brooklyn that won dance contests all the time. And they're just terrific, terrific to watch them. When we auditioned actors, dancers in New York, all the dancers in the chorus lines of the different Broadway shows were really angry at us because we kept turning them down. They looked like dancers. They walked like dancers. They carried themselves like dancers. And we wanted people that looked like ordinary people, you know. We picked all the people that never get picked. The guy who's a little too heavy set, the little tiny Asian girl who never got a job, and we used all of them in this movie, plus lots of the local women who were really good.
Can I wipe off your forehead?
So, Denny Dillon, who you will know, you'll recognize her from Dream on HBO, that she was on for many years, plus Saturday Night Live, of course. And she always had a great comedic talent.
I love to watch you dance, Tony.
Now, here is a little-known fact, and probably, if you don't like gross things, close your ears. Poor Denny Dillon was so terrified the day that we started shooting that she got some monstrous cold sore, and that's why it looks like we're shooting her through linoleum. And it seemed like half the female cast came down with cold sores from the terror of working on this movie. Okay, you can open yours right back up now.
Hey, you want some
more?
But she was just so cute and so funny, and, you know, when she went on to Saturday Night Live later, you know, she deserved it in her HBO show.
Oh, my God. Hey,
oh, Jesus.
You can't dance to this shit.
I thought I was fucked.
The floor was actually designed so that it would work rhythmically with the music. And the music was piped through the floor, and somehow the lights would react to the signals that were given to it by the music. But then we decided we wanted it to be more specific. So one of the women sitting up with the DJ would maneuver the lights to go along with the dancers and pick different patterns, and it made it really good. Now, we're watching Karen Lynn Gorney here as her character is introduced.
Joe,
yeah.
You know that girl?
No.
You ever seen her before?
No.
Oh, yeah, I seen her here about a month ago.
This was an interesting subject of casting, because probably every woman in New York and every young woman in Los Angeles came to audition for this role. And it was the most difficult part to cast, because you wanted somebody who had a very real quality for Brooklyn, You wanted somebody who seemed like they grew up in the neighborhood, who didn't seem like a pretty Hollywood girl, but she was still attractive. And somehow you wanted somebody who had some charm and fun to her, and not accentuate the negative parts of the personality. I mean, what John Travolta brings to this part is great charm, even though as a person the character has a lot of negative traits. He treats women terribly. Watch him here in this scene with Donna Pescal. My poor dear mother would turn in her grave if she watched this piece of behavior right here, where the man did not light the cigarette for the woman.
The prize money, $500.
So he has lots of negative qualities to his character, but because John as a person brings such charm to the role, he can have us forgive him. We love him anyway, in spite of it.
We won before.
But we're going to have to practice.
The stripper in the background had never been in a movie before, but she suddenly, instantly knew how to match. And over the different takes that were done, different angles, she was always taking her bra off at exactly the same point, or her G-string, whatever it is. And she learned instantly how to do this. Of course, we were all paying attention to the dialogue here. We weren't watching her at all. You know, she had to be on her own.
And that the whole time you talked about your married sister.
You know, we were very serious about this and not looking at her.
I got the idea that all you was interested in was being a married sister yourself. I got bored with you. And look, who should I take care of, huh? Hey, Tony, look, Double J's been in the car 25 minutes with some chick. So what? So I can't get the selfish prick out. These guys can't do nothing without me, don't they?
One of the hardest jobs that I had to do was to pick the stripper and to pick the young woman who's out in the car simulating sex with Paul Pape. She had to be topless in order for it to have the right impact and so on. But nobody seemed to want to do this role. And even Playboy Playmates were... Oh, well, we can't say that we doubled Paul Pape's butt there. There it is for everybody to see. And lots of people turned this role down. But this young girl had been a dancer in Texas in a go-go club, and she didn't mind at all. And it was okay. But once we had selected her and she showed up on the set, I didn't know who she was with her clothes on. And I had to introduce her and Paul Pape, and then they had to take their clothes off and get into this and hook up right in front of camera and everybody.
What did you say your name was?
All the music in here is playing back as we're doing it, so that everybody is staying in sync with it. It's something that we did all the way through the movie, though it actually turned out to be a near tragic experience, because even though we had gone to such trouble, we didn't have a technical thing on the soundtrack known as a sync pulse, and that would keep it... always in sync with the film, and this didn't happen. Somebody had neglected to put the sync pulse on, so the music would always drift out of sync with the film, so that the dancers looked like they were offbeat and didn't know what they were doing. But it took us the longest time. We almost had to release the movie in monaural before we figured out how to solve it and get it back into sync so it would work naturally. This is a kind of line dance that was done at the time, and the late Gene Siskel said this was one of his favorite moments in movie history, the kind of coming together of all of these kids and how they were kind of unified in this kind of strange make-believe world. Meanwhile, I'm getting yelled at by the writer because we have smoke in the disco and smoke coming out. He said there's no disco in the world that has smoke, and from my theater background, I always knew that dry ice was really cool and would be fun here, And I thought, wouldn't it be interesting if we could slowly flood the entire club with dry ice, and by the end of it, we would bury the dancers in the dry ice that would have built up to such a high degree. So we were doing this, as I'm assuring Norman Wexler that maybe after this movie comes out, people will use smoke in discos. I think that tended to happen. We always let John ad-lib and do what he thought was right because he had such a instinctive feeling for what the character was like. This moment is a particular ad-lib. Now we're about to meet his grandmother again. This is not his grandmother. This is some actor who probably has never been heard from since. I don't know why we have the poster of him there.
Al Pacino.
Attica.
Give it a ball. Hey, you want to go see that Bruce Lee picture at the
office?
Hey, you want to know something?
As we're rehearsing this movie, in order to... you know, get a bonding between the guys here and a place in the neighborhood, we often would go out and rehearse these scenes in the neighborhood and let them just mess around and play with whatever came up in the situation. And, of course, there, as we see, that whole homophobic sound is just part of the way these guys are. And not done for sensationalism. It's just the whole coloration of them. In a way, it's very brave of the studios and Robert Stigwood to let us do a film where we would have these characters doing such kind of negative behavior, because the traditional common wisdom among movie executives is, you know, your good guys have to be good all the way through. And, of course, that's boring, but that's what... a lot of old-fashioned thinking was at that time.
Dog world, right? Everybody's out for what they can get.
That's true. They got it all locked up. Ain't nobody gonna give you a chance.
Nobody gives you nothing, Joey.
Yeah, you know, it's every man for himself. It's a stinking rat race.
As we talked about the Brooklyn Bridge and how it separated people from Manhattan, the other, you know, theme that goes along with that is how you're kind of just stuck in this environment your whole life, as the kids are talking about in the car. You know, you don't get anything where, you know, kind of where you start out is where you end up. And, you know, Travolta's character, Tony, sees himself as probably lasting in this paint store for the rest of his life, which it takes him a long time to understand this is not something he wants to do. But there's a fatalistic attitude among all of the kids that, you know, that's just the way it is, and that's what you kind of have to put up with. And part of the magic of his character is that he eventually comes to realize there's more to life than working in the paint store. In the words of Jerry Seinfeld, not that there's anything wrong with that.
Shit-ass happy over a crummy 250 raise.
Wait a minute, you just said $4, didn't you?
What the hell are you doing?
I just feel like it, right?
Girls do that.
I got a raise today. How you like that?
Yeah. Why don't you say so during dinner? We could have used the conversation. Put them down. Come on. How much you get?
It's going to be $4. It was $2.50, right? But he raised the raise when he found out I wasn't so disappointed.
$4?
Yeah.
John has an ability to say these kind of goofy things that don't quite make sense, but it's like his father was Yogi Berra in making up slightly scrambled statements, like about the raise and what he'll later say in a rehearsal about whether he made a step up or not. We'll hear that. And I always let these kind of goofy ad libs go through because they were they're just so much fun and so quirky.
Why aren't you waiting inside?
Well, I wanted to watch you come down the street. I like the way you walk.
Ah, shit.
Pony, listen, I've been thinking. Maybe I'll make it with you.
That's what you call thinking, huh? Jesus Christ. You know, you're too much in that, you know that?
Here's an interesting, this is one of the first Steadicam shots that I ever was able to do, and you couldn't have done this shot 2 years before this movie, where we're coming down steps. So we've gone down one flight of stairs. Now we'll continue to go down. You just couldn't make a camera do this. It would have had to been on some kind of heavy crane that would never have fit through all of these kind of openings. And the Steadicam was a great liberating force. Some would say too liberating, you know, as it gets overused in time. But it allowed you to do a kind of shot that you could not have done before. And Alfred Hitchcock used to have to invent all kinds of very devious techniques to get long, continuous takes through different places.
It's always busting my onions. I send them a lot of customers, you know, gives me free studio time with them.
What do you mean 65%?
Well, that means that he scores with 65% of the chicks that come in here. And 1, 2, 3, 1, 2, 1, 2, 3, 1, 2, 1, 2, 3, good, 2, 2, 3, good, 1, 2, 1, 2, 3, good, that's it.
We had a terrible time getting music for this film. We had the Bee Gees songs always, and that was great. They were, you know, our partners in this operation. But they said, well, all the music shouldn't be theirs. We should have some from, you know, other composers. And everybody we went to would say, no, you can't have my song because I'm going to do my own disco movie. And so in this particular area, we had a song by Boz Scaggs called Lowdown, which was very popular at the time. And I actually recorded the dialogue and the music at the same time, which you're not supposed to do. But I thought it would be kind of interesting to experiment and having them actually record with the music. Well, no sooner had we finished shooting the scene than we got word from Boz Scaggs' people that they weren't going to let us have this song. So all the dialogue in that scene had to be replaced in the studio. And the composer, David Shire, had to write the piece of music that you heard there, which was then picked up by all the networks, and it used to open and close all the National Football League games for years. So David Shire made a ton of money off somebody else's refusal.
Hey, you know, you're a very good dancer, you know that? I would like to meet you.
Look, would you mind just going away, okay?
What?
Don't be hurt, but I
don't be hurt.
Yeah, I want to be by myself now, you know?
So I seen you 2001?
Yeah, so?
Well, I mean, you was looking at me and I was looking at you, remember?
But what if I look at a guy longer than a millionth of a second, already he gets delusions of grandeur?
You know what you are? I'm going to tell you what you are.
I bet it begins with a C, Mr. P.
Oh, fine. That's... I know the type. What are you doing up so late? What is this, a walk-in? You don't got no criticism?
A whole other theme that Norman Wexler wanted to pursue here was a Catholic family in Brooklyn and how devout they were, and the most valuable thing that they could think of was to have their son become a priest. And probably the least valuable was to have their son be out dancing in a discotheque. So, of course, the fact that Tony's brother Frank is a priest is great joy and comfort to the mother. when he has come home here, as we'll find out, and decided that he's leaving the priesthood, they're devastated. They couldn't think of a worse thing to happen. The shame of the family and maybe even the unconscious feeling that they've lost connection with the Lord. You know, it's like wanting your son to be a doctor, that it'll get you through your old age. Maybe your son as a priest will, you know, help get you into heaven.
You think I'm losing my hair? It looks awful thin right over here and here. Are you serious?
Can I borrow some of your clothes until I buy some? I don't want to wear the uniform.
I'm sorry, Frank. I really am. I'm sorry.
What are you sorry about?
You got fired, huh?
I didn't get fired. I quit.
You quit?
Yeah, you can do those things, you know?
What did Mom say? What did she say about it?
She said, "Dear Lord, what am I going to tell Teresa and Marie?"
And Dad, what did he say about it?
Shame for both of them. They're ashamed, right? You ashamed, don't you, Tom?
Yeah. Didn't ask why or nothing?
Nah. I think they're afraid to. Like I might say, celibacy.
It's interesting that the perception of John Travolta at the time of this movie was that he was a personality, not a real actor, that he was just playing himself. Scenes like this, you can absolutely see the kind of acting that he's capable of. There's a real sensitivity and emotionality that comes through so clearly if you just take the time to look. Over the time, in various films, he proved himself, but it was written off at the time as just a guy doing himself. And I knew, and anybody close to the film knew, what a genuine acting talent we had here, as well as a major star. And it's a true, true treat and joy to have been able to work with somebody at that beginning. Not to mention how much easier it makes it for the director to have somebody who so deeply understands the character.
Mama and Papa, their dreams of pious glory. They turn you into what they wish at a time. You can't defend yourself against their fantasies. All I ever really had any belief in was their image of me as a priest. So...
This speech actually had gone on for about 2.5 or 3 minutes, but it probably said things way too much and hit things over the head, so it all ultimately had to be cut down to about 3 sentences, and the poor actor had to come back in and redo all of it because it just sounded chopped up, but once he redid it, it had a nice, smooth quality to it.
Yeah, maybe if you ain't so good, I ain't so bad, you know?
And of course he was very upset. He took it personally. We were cutting it down because he wasn't very good, and that wasn't the case at all. It was we had given him too much speech to say, and you know, it wasn't going to play. Not his fault at all. He did it beautifully.
What are you doing?
My brother, he quit the church. You believe that?
Yeah.
I feel wild. I got all this energy. I can't believe it.
Yeah.
Listen, I'll call you later tonight, all right?
Yeah, well, just, hey.
See you later, Gus. I'll see you.
Come on, buddy, higher with the
arms. Yeah, that's it.
Yeah, do it.
We were lucky to get one of the silly disco hits of the time, Disco Duck, written by Rick Dees, who's a radio personality in Los Angeles, and he would do very funny and very clever things. So for that adults class in disco, it was a wonderful combination.
Yeah.
Karen Lynn Gorney looks so wonderful here, but we had made a terrible mistake in originally letting her be in some kind of a black outfit that unfortunately looked like she was some kind of dominatrix. And yeah, I think she had dark glasses on just to add insult to injury. I'm sitting there watching it and not realizing how silly it looked and what a bad choice we had made. And the next morning at 6 o'clock in the morning when I'm in Deluxe Laboratories looking at the Daily Silent, I just groaned at the mistake. And we, the next morning before we went on with our regular day's work, we came back in and had put her in this lovely pink and redid the entire scene so that it looked the way it ought to look, you know, and make a really pretty couple and make her look as attractive as she was.
Well, I'm 19 at the moment, but I'll be 20 very shortly.
What I think is this. There's a world of difference between us, you know, not just chronologically, but emotionally, culturally, physically, every which way. And this world would get much bigger and much worse with every passing week.
What kind of shit is that?
Coffee, not sex.
It's coffee. Hey, look, where I work, the people are very remarkable. They're not like these Bay Ridge people at all.
You mean snobs instead of slobs, right?
What?
No. Hey, you know, Bay Ridge ain't the worst part of Brooklyn. You know what I'm talking? I mean, you know, ain't like a hellhole or nothing.
Yeah, well.
This is wonderful, wonderful area where the restaurant was located. And we wanted to see how much of it we could do in one shot. So we've had them walking down the street. And now we'll just bring them into the restaurant and get them down at the table. It's one of those fun things that directors do that probably nobody really notices, but they get their kicks. Me too. I'm no exception to that. But I like the feeling of seeing them through the glass and, you know, getting the reflection of the city outside. And at the same time, seeing into the restaurant.
Romeo and Juliet. I never understood why Romeo, he took the poison so quick, you know. I feel like he could have waited or something.
Well, that's the way they took the poison in those days.
Hey, you going to eat here? Look at the menu.
No, I just have tea with lemon. Started drinking tea recently, you know. It's really a lot more refined.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah. All those women executives in my office, they all drink tea with lemon.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah.
One of the wonderful things about this scene is the nature of the dialogue, where they you know, these kids are trying to pretend like they're a lot more sophisticated than they are, and, of course, showing how unsophisticated they are by the kind of comments that they make about Laurence Olivier and Polaroids and tea with lemon and then all of their aspirations to a kind of world that just seems so magical and distant. But she wants to pretend that, you know, she's really up on all of this. So obviously anybody that says Bonwit Taylor hasn't quite got it all together.
No, I'm not really.
So what did you say far out for?
Because it sounded like far out, wasn't it? I mean,
oh, yeah.
We'd like a lemon with some tea now, and I'd like a cheeseburger and some coffee.
So here's, you know, Tony Manero, who is so sure of himself and so slick and clever in the world of disco and around his gang. He's now reduced to just a kind of bumbler when up against this this young lady who's a pretender, and she herself is you know, trying to be out of her limits, but he's hit a kind of glass ceiling as to where he can go. He's got a lot of sophistication before he'd ever be able to make it in any other town than Brooklyn.
I'm the brightest, I'm the most vivacious thing in the entire office he's seen in years.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah.
Do you think that you could get, like, a camera from him and, like, a discount?
I didn't ask him about a camera.
Because you got one already, right? You still have Fox.
Okay, look, are you enjoying all this stuff I'm telling you?
Sure, it's good.
I think maybe you can't handle hearing about a kind of life that is so completely different than yours.
You mean better, don't you?
Yes, I mean better. Sure, it's better.
I have some ketchup, please.
I mean, I'm out of this scene almost completely, you know, this Bay Ridge scene. I'm moving into Manhattan, I'm getting my own apartment. I'm changing.
I'm really changing as a person, and I'm growing. You know what I mean? Nobody has any idea how much I'm growing.
As this scene goes on, you'll notice that it's actually getting darker and darker outside the windows, and the light's going down, and we just wanted to have the sense of time passing and the light changing as it moves from late afternoon into dark.
Because I don't think guys like you anymore for one thing. You're too young, you haven't got any class, and yeah, I'm sick of jerk-off guys ain't got their shit together.
Come on, it's easy to get your shit together. All you need is a salad bowl and a potato masher. Get your shit together. Would you like to know what I do?
It's not necessary.
I'll tell you what I do. I work in a paint store, and I got raised this week.
Right, you work in a paint store, right?
Yeah.
You probably live with your family, you hang out with your buddies, and on Saturday night you go, you blow it all off 2001, right?
That's right.
You're a cliche. You're nowhere. On your way to no place.
What do you got, a fucking stairway to the stars or what?
Yeah, maybe.
Yeah.
I'm taking a course night at the new school. Next semester I'm going to take two. Now you probably didn't get no college, did you?
No, I did not.
Well, did you ever think about going to college?
No.
Not ever?
No, Jew.
Well, not back then, no.
What the fuck are you bugging me about for?
Well, why not? Why didn't you ever want to...
It's scenes like this that I think show us why this film works 25 years later. And a lot of the other films that were made around that time that were trying to be, you know, disco movies, dance movies, didn't work. This has such a wonderful depth of character. And again, it goes back to Norman Wexler's script. That he had written such interesting, complex characters that were not cartoons, and you know, they had lots of dimensions to them, lots of facets, and we see ourselves in these characters. You know, we're laughing, kind of a little at them, a little with them. We see our own weaknesses, our own pretensions, and you know what it really is like to be a kid and out trying to get started in the world.
Stephanie, I can walk you home.
Look, nothing personal, right?
Oh, come on, Stephanie, I can walk you.
I think none of us would ever want to have to go through high school again. It's just too painful back there, and to, you know, watch people kind of going through all of those kind of difficulties is at least it's done with some humor, and we can say, thank God, I don't have to be in that kind of world.
What's the matter? What's going on?
It's Gus, man. He's in the hospital.
It's Spanish
Barons.
They're cooties.
Hey, that's my fucking call!
Get the car!
Just give me the keys.
You're asking for
it.
You know, I can't believe it. I just saw him.
He could have run, you know? But he hung tight. That's Gus.
Don't worry about him, right?
I got in the hospital to see him. He got a broken nose, busted ribs, a broken leg, and four teeth knocked out.
Jeez.
I mean, all he was doing was walk along the street carrying his groceries and treat him to a shelf number on him. Spoons fucking groceries into the street. So, you know, he sort of says under his breath, grease balls, stick dicks, and they laid into him.
I always wanted to see that scene where he was beaten up. I always thought it was, you know, weak dramatically to have a scene where a major character is beaten up off stage. But Norman Wexler insisted that we should see everything from Travolta's point of view. The story was written from his point of view, and it would not be fair to suddenly get a scene that was away from him. And as you look at this, you realize that Tony Manero is involved in every single scene, that we're not really away from him ever. He's in the room or in the neighborhood wherever something is going on.
Yeah. We'll just pick off a couple on the street, yeah.
Oh, that's pussy, man.
Oh, God. You're fucked
there,
up.
No,
I'm sorry.
Fucking
I'm sorry.
I'll forget it. Forget it tomorrow.
All right, dream good. Jerk off better.
Tony. Getting married.
Will you cut it with that shit?
Now listen, I just want to let you know, alright?
Alright, look, if you get married, we'll all go with you on your honeymoon, alright?
Will? Okay.
Good.
Take it easy.
Come on, Bobby, get in the car. Hey, you know, we should go to hospital tomorrow. You know what I'm talking? And you cool off. You know? Alright, good night.
one of those directorial chores is, how do you show the absence of somebody? How do you show that somebody is not there? And a little problem for me to work out, you know, looking at the empty plates and empty chairs and so on. At least I had some place where we had established that he ought to be sitting.
He stays out all night, he don't come back.
I said nothing to him.
Priest staying out all night.
A priest is not a priest no more, and he's grown up, so he can do what he wants.
Something you said to him.
Oh, yeah, you trying to blame me that he ain't a priest no more?
You've been writing to him.
I don't believe this. You're trying to hang this on me.
Forget it. Oh, no, he called. In a couple of days, he's going to see he's wrong. He's going through like a trial of the soul, you know? He's going back to the church. He's going back.
No, he won't. He's not going back to the church.
He's going back to the church. I'm telling you. He's going back.
He's not ever going back. You don't got a priest no more. And you got no saint. You got nothing but three shit children now. Good. Good.
No.
I'm sorry, Mom. I don't mean that. I'm sorry. I never say that. I love you, Mom. I really do.
Come on. Good.
How you doing, Annette?
Okay.
That's good.
Yeah.
Listen, look, Annette, I gotta tell you something, right? It's very hard to tell you this, but I changed my mind about us dancing together. I got another partner.
Now, there's some traditional wisdom, more common sense, which maybe not so common, but traditional thinking about movies that things all have to have the same tone. That a comedy should always be funny, and everybody should have a very light, skippy kind of thing. Dramatic movies should be very dark and very serious, with no jokes and no light moments. But as we know, life as we live it has all of this stuff mixed up. It doesn't suddenly one day say today's going to be a comedy. Some days it is a tragedy. But you know, we mix up humor and you know, sad things and serious things and so on. All are coming one right after the other, and I think that's another part of the appeal of this the movie, because we have allowed all of these moments. You know, where he has this very, very dark scene with his family, with his mother, and then another one with his girlfriend, and yet now he's here in a rehearsal where the tone, you know, completely changes. And we are just shifting gears constantly to different tones in the movie, and yet the overall unified result, hopefully, is what, you know, closer to what life is really like.
Follow me.
Here's one of the really wonderful ad-libs that I had mentioned to you earlier, where once she asks if he made this step up.
Yeah, that's really nice. What did you do, make that up?
Yeah, no, I saw it on TV first, and then I made it up.
Now, what does that mean? I mean, it's, and yet it makes sense. I think that Yogi Berra really was his father. Get to shift into the big room here. Nice big rehearsal hall.
Now we commence.
Can we show you step K, the Latin one I was going to show you, okay? I'll take your hand like this. I'll come. One, two, three, two, two, three, two, three, two, three, two, three.
Okay, I got that.
Okay.
That's good. That's good, I like that.
Yeah.
Do you know the Tango Hustle?
Here.
Here, just try that.
This tango dance came about because the choreographer forgot he was supposed to show up at work that day, and he had booked a fashion show. And so my assistant, Colleen Murphy, and John Travolta made up this dance over lunch while we were trying to get going, and came up with a whole new kind of dance with a tango step, and plus the old-fashioned dip here. That was so much fun. That's something I remember from high school, was if you could really be cool, you could do the dip. And if you look really carefully, it's hard to see it. The camera will show up in the mirrors in the background. It's tough, but we're there. We didn't realize we were seeing ourselves. Ah, yes, I see us back there. And then doing these kind of close-ups where we literally attached a rope to Karen Lynn Gorney or to John, and then John and the operator would go around to the camera operator and spin in circles. The hardest part was they had to get on the same foot at the same time, or it was the worst looking shot you ever saw, with the actor's head bouncing out of frame more than it was in frame.
All that shit on me and everything.
Oh yeah, well,
John's popularity was such that any time we went out on the street, we were, Lord knows what would happen, as people would discover that we were there. Now, here we are at 2 o'clock in the morning doing this scene, and across the street there's about 2,000 people watching, and they're screaming and carrying on, holding up signs, you know, some saying, John, we love you, and some guys holding up signs saying, John, we hate you. And I kept thinking, how in the world can these actors keep continuing the way they are and keep their concentration with all of that distraction going on across the street, especially when a lot of it was very personally directed at John by guys who didn't like the fact that their girlfriends were all excited about seeing him.
Interesting, yeah. Intelligent? No, maybe. I don't know. I got to know you better. You know what I mean? You got a way of putting things together, you know? Seeing things a certain way. Interesting? Yeah, yeah. Intelligent? Yeah, maybe. Maybe intelligent.
Well, what do you know? Da-da-sh. All right.
Hey, Stephanie, how come we never talk about how we feel when we're dancing? How come we never talk about that?
Good night and thanks.
No, but look, maybe I can walk you the rest of the way.
You know, we've talked about the battle of the sexes that's going on here. And here's an interesting role reversal where the guy is the vulnerable one, vulnerable over his sexuality, his intelligence, and he's being manipulated by the woman. So much of this movie is about those kind of relationships, that the person who is the standoffish one is the one that's being pursued. And Donna Pascal is pursuing John Travolta because he's being standoffish with her, and Travolta is pursuing Karen Lynn Gorney because she's being standoffish with him. It's all, you know, that kind of game playing and role playing that continues to go on. I wonder if cavemen were this way. You know, no, I'm sorry, I have a headache tonight.
Hey, what's happening, Tony? Hey, how you doing?
How you doing?
Hey, Double J.
There, I think on the right of the screen, there may be the director coming through at some point. I seem to remember that. There I am, right on the right. Oh, I saw that mustache. I had the worst mustache in the history of the planet. After me, they were thinking about banning mustaches forever because it was so scraggly looking. And the makeup people offered to fill it in with pencil. Of course, it looked like the makeup people had filled it in with pencil.
They know what faces that sometimes.
How you like your father?
What father? I look like your father?
Please don't call me that. I never could stand that.
But yeah, I think the place is, energizing.
Hey, great. It's all right.
It's great. Great, huh? Very good place. Burn them up now.
Now, this is Fran Drescher here. Fran Drescher from The Nanny. And this was one of the hardest roles to cast because even though the character is supposed to be this kind of slutty girl, nobody wanted to do it. Nobody could do it, bring it off and have that kind of teasing quality that that Fran Drescher has here in this scene. And she just nailed it when she came in for the reading. And on the day of shooting, as she's dressed in this particular outfit, she looked at me and she said, "You know what? I don't have any underwear on." And that was her whole kind of setting up for being this, you know, teasing girl working at John and seeing this verbal duel between the two of them, which is so funny. The battle between the sexes.
I bet you wouldn't allow us to fuck.
So how come they always send me flowers the next day, huh?
You know, some guys don't know allows you to fuck when they got one, you know what I mean?
Oh, yeah?
Maybe they thought she was dead.
Bob, want to hear something? Listen, I got a girlfriend of mine, you know, she's such a...
You know, and then we shift into this sad, funny kind of thing that's going on with Bobby C. consistently. You know, everybody thinks it's a joke, but by the end of the movie, we know that it's not a joke.
Get this.
Look out, get the kid in the room. He's taking over again.
Now watch this. Watch this. John Travolta is doing what his dancing instructor had demonstrated for him the first night he started to study. And he could go out onto a dance floor and literally clear the dance floor, and people would get back and watch what he was doing. And as you know, he hosted Dance Fever for many years after that, after he had taught John how to dance. Well, John was horrified because when he saw the kind of athletic things that were being expected of him, he wanted to quit the movie right then. He called Robert Stigwood and said, "I can never do this." And Robert, being a tough, wily old Australian that he is, you know, got him to stay and to stay with his dancing and coaching. And, you know, he needed a lot of muscle strength and athletic ability to do this. And my job as a director was to stay right with him and focus it and get that quality on film. When Fred Astaire was dancing in the musicals at MGM, he had a clause in his contract that he had to be filmed from head to toe all the time. He wanted to be seen that way, and that was because he didn't want it to look like the dancing had been faked. Here, we went with the same principle. You know, we wanted to see his dancing, that he was really doing it. And so there is an occasional close-up or two, but there is no question here as to who's doing the dancing. And that was very important to John and very important to all of us. Because it is easy to use a dance double and a little bit of cleverness and, you know, pace the dance together from various different parts.
Oh, okay.
He's very good, yeah.
He's the king out there, Father.
When he would finish one of these takes, he would be absolutely drenched. And like a lot of dancers and circus performers, they make things look so easy, and yet it's truly, truly exhausting.
Hey, Frank, listen.
Yes.
Come here, you want to hear something? Listen, I got my girlfriend, you know? Can I tell you something?
Yeah.
Come here for a sec. Listen, Frank, want to hear something? I got a lot of ideas. You see, like I was reading up about the Pope. Hey,
now, as we swing into this, you know, this very dark... what ultimately becomes dark, but you know, at this point we're thinking that it's kind of funny here. This kid is so kind of confused, and we always let Barry Miller go where he wanted to, make the dialogue his own. He's kind of confused and bumbling and repeating himself, but it was part of the charm. I didn't want him to have to stick to the dialogue, you know, but he's trying to find ways to explain things that he's uncomfortable with explaining. And, you know, it certainly reflects the mores of the time that, you know, he made the girl pregnant, so he's got to marry her. That kind of more changes constantly. But at this point, you know, he sees his life being ruined as he's trapped in a marriage that's of his making but not of his wish.
You play, you pay, you know? It's funny, huh?
Don't forget everything. Now, Monty Rock III was our DJ. So much of his commentary keeps this alive, and his you know, wry sense of humor as he makes fun of the wardrobe and so on like that. We would just turn the camera on him and let him go. It's always a, you know, a treat to see what was going to come out of Monty Rock's mouth.
Tony, it was really great.
Oh, you liked it?
Yeah, listen, I'm going to go home now, eh?
You're going to go home?
Yeah.
No, stay a little longer, Frank. It's nice just beginning right
now. Yeah, I know, but it's not my scene, you know?
No.
Come on, you didn't expect me to stay a whole night, did you?
No, I didn't. Yes, I thought maybe you'd stay a little more. No, it's not your scene, of course not.
I'm sorry,
Tony. Don't worry about it. It's not, you know. So what, right? Come on. Walk to the door.
Hey, you know, your dancing is really marvelous. It's exciting. I mean, it's exciting to watch you out there. They can't keep their eyes off you. I gotta go now, okay?
All right, well, have a good night. I'll see you later, right?
These wonderful outfits here, the silver vest that the bouncers were wearing was actually a dead copy of what they wore in the disco. We can't blame it on Patrizia von Brandenstein, who was the costume designer. This is the lady that won an Academy Award for her production design of Amadeus. Here she was having to do things with literally no money and no budget and, you know, borrowing clothes all over the place and buying them in the store.
We could make it now.
What?
We ain't practicing. We've seen each other, like you said, so we could make it.
Look, Annette, we make it when I decide, all right? No other time.
All right.
When I say so, all right?
I'll just make it with somebody else.
We have watched. This is so interesting to see a character continually trying to break through to Tony. You know, she's standoffish, and then she's kind of begging him, and now she's trying to make him jealous. And it's really, really interesting character stuff. We get one of the great ad-libs from John here at the end of this scene as they're... They're not able to make it in the back seat of this car.
No. What do you got? The IOU, that thing? Huh?
No.
No diaphragm? Nothing?
It doesn't matter, though.
You don't got nothing?
It doesn't matter. Tony, I love you.
Are you kidding me?
No.
Oh, forget it. Just give me a blowjob, right? Come on.
Nowadays, since it's been pronounced by the President of the United States that a blowjob does not constitute sex, this would probably not be a shocking kind of thing. At the time, this is probably the first time that the word blowjob had been uttered in movies anywhere, and the whole theater would kind of come to a standstill when they heard it.
Bennett, cigarette?
Guess not.
Here's another great piece that Mussorgsky's Night on Bald Mountain that was turned into a disco number. You can hear it in Fantasia at the very end of the very scary Night on Bald Mountain. But we thought it was really appropriate for these kids.
Annette, can you dig it? I knew that was good.
Whoa.
you got, man? Come on, Tony, let's get him!
Come on, let's go.
Hey, come on, let's get the fucking stove, motherfucker!
Hey, Tarzan!
This is one of the most wonderful kind of improvisations, teamwork between actors and director, because we discovered that there was this built-in safety place that you could walk onto, and yet if we hid it from the audience and from the Donna Pascal character, that that we could have a good time with everybody, as she thinks that they've jumped off into... you know, into space and gotten killed, and the audience probably thinks that too. You certainly never want the audience to get ahead of the characters, or they think the characters are stupid.
House, what do you think?
I'll do until I figured out my next move.
Yeah.
What about you?
What about me?
Are you going to do something with your dancing, Tom?
I don't know. I don't, people ask me all the time, but I don't know. I mean, you know, I feel like my whole life, right?
So much of this movie underneath is dealing with Tony Manero's character trying to get him out of this environment into an environment where he can use his potential, and he's scared to do it. Everybody keeps telling him. His brother's telling him here, you know, his friends are telling him. Everything is saying, get the heck out of here, you know, go and do something else, and yet he's frightened to do it. You can see it in his eyes here. And yet, eventually, by the end of the movie, he will finally make that big step. And for those of you who are into symbolism here, you can get just a little bit of it. So for the English class or film appreciation, you know, here we have symbolic moment of what the priesthood does to you.
Hi. So what are you staying here for?
How come you wasn't there Saturday night?
I didn't say I was going to be there Saturday night.
Fuck you didn't.
I said maybe. Maybe's a maybe. I didn't think you could go and get upset about it.
Oh, forget upset. I'm not upset. It's just that we needed to practice. I mean, you know, you should have been here.
All right, right. Let's practice then.
You can't. I don't bring the records because I don't think you was going to be here.
Yeah, so what'd you come for, huh?
A lot of the language in this picture had to be covered for television. And we knew that we couldn't have people saying fuck and shit and worse all through a film and have it ever go on television. So I told Robert Stigwood that we would have to, you know, do television coverage. He told me not to worry about it, that it would be fine. But I knew better, and I knew that eventually, you know, the movie would be sold to ABC or one of the networks, and they were not going to allow it in. So I would say to these young actors, when we had finished doing a take the regular way, okay, now we have to do a take where we cut all the language out. They said absolutely not. They were not going to do it. They were not going to violate the integrity of the movie. And, you know, we're going to do this language the way it was. And if it wasn't in there for television, that was too bad. So I looked at them and didn't know quite what to do. And I finally said, you know what? Have you guys ever heard of something called residuals? And they go, no, what's that? I said, well, residuals are when your movie gets played on television, you see money. And you keep seeing it as long as the movie runs. But I guess this probably won't ever go on television, so you guys won't see residuals. And they kind of looked at each other and they said, okay, let's go for those alternate takes. And in a lot of situations, it turned out that those were better acting takes than the ones with all the profanity. probably because the actors relaxed, knowing, this is just for TV. And yet they did a better job because they were more relaxed. And relaxation is one of the great keys to good acting. These are the real employees of the White Castle having their moment on film. They were all terrified, but I told them not to worry. This is what they did every day, and they could just be themselves, and they were. They were very, very good, and we never knew what the actors were going to do to get a reaction from them. At that point, the reaction that we saw was with Double J pulling his pants down, and he mooned the entire staff of the White Castle.
You'd have to marry me.
Yeah. I think I get an abortion. Hey, so long, John.
It's very nice meeting you.
So what'd you guys think of her?
Hey, Tony, I liked her. I thought she was nice. I liked her a lot.
Yeah, she's a snotty bitch, man. She's cool. You just gotta get to know her. That's all.
Hey, Tony, you fuck her yet?
What do you think?
I don't think so.
You guys got a lot of growing up to do, you know that? Not a grown up, you're babies.
Hey, Mr. Fusco. Look, I need the afternoon off.
And here, you know, this is a really good scene for, you know, seeing this war with Tony and his boss. And, you know, he's feeling this pull, but he can't get out. He's got, he's stuck with his boss keeping him in the store.
Look, I gotta have the afternoon off. I'm taking it.
You do, you're fired.
I'm doing it.
Then you're fired.
Then fuck you, asshole.
Tony, Tony, I don't want to marry Pauline. I don't give a fuck about this cunt.
Marry you.
Tony, I gotta marry her.
Had to do this scene at 6:30 in the morning. Why do we have to do it at 6:30 in the morning? Because if we did any later, the people of Brooklyn would discover us, and so we'd get out there as early as possible to do these scenes before they figured out where we were, and then we would take refuge in the paint store or the dance hall. Somewhere like that. So these are all local extras. But if we had been found, we would have been totally harassed.
Really? Don't worry about nothing. You're great. I'm in a terrible rush. I hate to leave you like this. You got no idea how much I appreciate this. I mean, this car is very important for me today, you know?
Will you call me tonight?
Yeah, I'll call you. Don't worry.
I think there's one of the wonderful discovered moment here as Bobby C. is, you know, left all by himself and he walks away from us. The whole, you know, sad, pathetic, funny nature of it is revealed just in the walk away. And it was a kind of an accident. We didn't really intend it to be. I'd like to take credit for it. But the minute you see those shoes, there's a huge laugh, and yet you feel sorry for the guy. It's one of those little, if I can use a $10 word, serendipitous moments that, you know, makes the film a lot richer. And I got a lot of credit for it and probably had nothing to do with it other than say, you know, walk away from the camera.
You know, you couldn't do it on Sunday, so my boss, he fired me.
Well, I just wanted to get everything in, you know, so I could start fixing up when I move in on Saturday.
Yeah.
Well, nobody bitched at my office. I got the whole day off. Hey, I'm sorry.
Oh, sure, no problem. No big deal, I can handle it.
So here we're making our first transition into Manhattan. Now, looking at it again, I knew I needed a shot of John Travolta in the car looking at Manhattan from his point of view, you know, to go with this shot. And we were really rushed for our schedule, so I never got it, and I always feel the lack of it, you know, the kind of the awe of coming into Manhattan. And up here to, I think it was about 76th Street, just west of Central Park, that we shot this and found this very nice brownstone loft apartment.
Okay, come on.
the actors were all over me to play this particular kind of part, but I, knowing that I'm really a terrible actor, I said, no, and they just kept teasing me for days about it, but I'm glad that that I refused, because then you'd have had to sit here and watch a pretty dreadful, uptight performance from somebody who doesn't do this for his day job.
Super anymore. Can I get you a beer, a glass of wine?
No, man, like it's all right. Hey, I read that book you told me to, you know, the...
Kerr or the Lawson?
The Kerr.
Should have read the Lawson. Listen, if I can help you guys move in, you just say the word, we'd be glad to help.
Yeah, we were a lot better off with Don Gantry playing that role than with me.
I get the rest of the stuff. Stephanie, who is that guy?
Oh, he's an arranger, record producer. He wants to do films. Oh, he's going to move now to a more...
Now, this scene, this is interesting. This is a complete reshoot from the original scene, because in the original shooting, they're driving out of Manhattan and driving along the road, and they get into this terrible, terrible argument that that we're watching here. And it just didn't work. I think it was a big mistake of me to try driving along and having them act and have such an emotional scene at the same time. And again, in one of those 6 o'clock in the morning revelations in the lab, I said, "Boy, this is just dreadful, and it's not their fault. It's my fault for putting him in this." So, at 9 o'clock that morning, we did this scene, and it worked absolutely beautifully. You know, they were able to concentrate and focus on what the scene was about rather than thinking about driving and so on. Karen was able to cry, and the emotion came, you know, flooding out. And the day before, you know, it had been a total disaster. So it was a good lesson for me not to be trying to do so much emotion in a, you know, situation where people have to be doing other things, walking and driving and so on.
All right, come on. Let's get out of here.
Oh, sorry.
Sorry. Don't worry about nothing. Don't worry about that. Don't worry about nothing. Stephanie, don't.
So this is the tag end of the original scene that I shot.
No, come on. I'll sit here for a while, right?
Part that worked actually pretty nicely and linked the two bits together.
It's pretty, isn't it?
This bridge, which is so beautiful from here, and then is so frightening when you're up above it. We were lucky to be able to, you know, find this really lovely, lovely angle on it that, you know, sets them as small characters underneath this huge, you know, beautiful symbol of New York.
Yards of concrete. That's right. The center span right there is 4,260 feet long. And with the on-ramps, it all together totals like something like 2.5 miles.
In the full version of this, which I don't know if we're going to have, but we sense John's fascination, or Tony Manero's fascination with the Verrazano Bridge. And earlier in the film, he is riding with his friends and makes them stop, let him out of the car. They drive off, and he stands looking at the bridge from afar and tracing the outlines of it with his fingers. Certainly it's you know, it's a very sweet kind of moment. It's certainly the fascination that he has with this construction, and you know, shows the softer side of his personality. But at the same time, his you know, sense of humor, as he talks about the poor guy who got buried in the concrete while they were building the bridge. think I saw him crying there.
Mr. Fusco, come for what I got coming.
Tony, come on. Things got a little out of this holler, don't you think?
What are you talking about?
I don't want to lose you, Tony. You're a good kid. Customers like you. I want you to stay on.
You mean I ain't fired?
No. Come on.
Jesus Christ, I don't believe this.
You got a future here, Tony. Here, Harold's with me 18 years since I opened. Mike, 15 years, huh?
There's Mike with his back problems, and, you know, it just... really nice, very simply seen that he sees that's his future. You know, Mike with the back problem and the other guy who's just standing there in his little gray outfit, and he's really beginning to get the sense that there's more to life.
Pete, what are you doing? Trying to get up to 70%?
Whoa, man. I didn't know you hung your label on it.
What are you doing? The guy's the biggest cunt hound in Bay Ridge.
Oh, my God, I've been in serious danger.
It's no fucking joke, Stephanie. That guy's a fucking sleazy whore.
I was dancing with the fella, you know, dancing.
No, forget it.
Come on, listen.
You disgust me, you know that?
What do you mean?
You're looking at take one on that scene, and often you can get the best emotional responses from actors on take one. And we decided that we would go in and, you know, shoot her close-up initially so that we'd have the benefit of that outflow of emotion, and then the scene just worked a treat. As they're holding the condoms up, this is an early example of product placement in films. I received a lifetime supply of condoms from Trojan myself, but I donated them to charity. There are really no stuntmen in New York at all. It's just not something that they do very much of. And so we had to bring our chief stunt coordinator from Los Angeles, and he was in the position of teaching Travolta's gang how to fight and to gathering up a group of Puerto Rican kids that he taught how to fight. So we really have amateur stuntmen in doing the fight that's about to ensue. This is more fun than a barrel of monkeys crashing through into the store. So we have these two amateurs, you know, fighting here, and two groups of amateurs, and of course there was a lot of disaster going on. Struggling to get this last shot before the light that you see, the blue light in the there, that's it. Dawn's coming up, and at least we're able to go home.
I was looking for you. Where were you?
This is a very, very, very tough neighborhood we were working in. It was all Hasidic Jewish people who lived in this neighborhood, And they may look peaceful and they may look calm and nice, but don't mess with them. And they'll come out and tear you up if they think that you're endangering their neighborhood. And as we're sitting in that car doing the shot of them driving along, the assistant director pointed out to me that he had been in a similar situation with Robert Redford on a movie called The Hot Rock. And I said, oh, that's nice. He said, yeah, they turned the car over on that day. And there he was with Robert Redford turned upside down in the middle of a Hasidic neighborhood.
Probably was.
Don't be
putting
on
legs now.
Wait a minute. You said it probably was.
That's right.
That's what
probably,
you told us.
I said probably because I wasn't sure, you know. I mean, it could have been a Spanish.
Stupid fucking bastard. We almost got our heads busted.
Yeah? Not you, Bubba.
You know, you got some fucking pair of balls on you. You know that
hey,
does.
Hey, come on. Hey, you know, I had to say something, right?
Here's our low-budget hospital. We're literally in somebody's garage. You can see the concrete block behind. And, you know, do it for no money. Try to make the hospital out of nothing.
Oh, God, I can't. Fuck a thing. You want to know something? I could have killed him.
You couldn't kill a fucking crab like.
Oh, shit, what do you think I am? You think I'm a coward?
What do you think you are?
Enough of that shit already. I'm bored. I'm bored with it, all right?
This discotheque was actually the subject of us being visited by the local mafia. They came around and were looking for a little bit of, wondered if we needed some help being protected. And I think the production manager said, no, we're fine here. We've got our own security. So one night, right where John and Karen are standing, there was a small fire built right up against the door. And they set the fire off and it burned a little bit and it was put out. And the next day, the boys came around in their big old Cadillac and said, well, we heard you boys had a little barbecue here last night. I was really curious to know what they wanted for that. It was $3,500. They knew how to get just enough out of you so you wouldn't complain, but enough so they could make money. These dancers were just fabulous. These guys are from Chorus Line, and here's a case where we really wanted great, great dancers, and that would be better than John and Karen. They had to be clearly better so that when John and Karen win the contest, we know that that it's been unfair. And I asked the local extras at the time, you know, what would you do if you saw dancers that were this good, that were African-American? And they said, we'd walk away. We wouldn't watch them. You're asking us to stand here and watch them, and we wouldn't do that.
And Tony Manero!
All right.
Another one of those, huh?
Hey, come on, you had enough.
So then we had to have a, you know, a decision about what kind of dance are they going to do here? Because we had these hot dances. And I said, okay, we better go just totally opposite it and do something very soft and romantic, because I don't think there's any way we're going to top those dancers. And we'll just go in a totally different direction. This white suit is another one of those kind of happy accidents. It sits today in the Smithsonian, and Gene Siskel was the first person to buy the suit, and yet it was almost a black suit, because that's what John wanted to wear, and he was insistent on it. And as he and Patrizia von Brandenstein are going out to buy the suit, I said to them, what are you going to get? They said, a black suit. And I said, well, I don't think you'll like that. Well, why not? I said, Karen Gorney will like it because, you know, she's in a light-colored dress and you'll be in a black suit. You'll just disappear, so all we'll be looking at is her. I think you should get a white suit. And so later that afternoon, they came back with two white suits, you know, one for take one and one for take two. I love this shot where it almost looks like they're underwater and we're shooting them in slow motion, but at a slow motion rate that is exactly right so they will stay on the beat. And as we were doing this, the cameraman was complaining bitterly that he had all his blue light flashing in front of him, but yet it just is such a wonderful romantic image. After every single one of these takes, John would have worked so hard here that the suit was just sopping wet. And they would peel it off him and dry him down and put the fresh suit on him. And then they would have to take the other one and get it dry again. So they were drying it with hair dryers. I mean, by the end of the day of doing this contest, these both suits were so funky. I mean, they could stand up by themselves. I think they just put some money in the pocket and told them to go off to the dry cleaners and put themselves in overnight.
Hey! Hey, be cool, baby! Here now we have couple number 15.
The Puerto Rican, Puerto Riqueño. Aquí tenemos a María, Hector, Isidro Rodríguez. Aquí vienen, aquí.
I'm being really rushed on our schedule at this point, and we just had to kind of get through this third couple, the Puerto Rican couple. And so I just kind of set the cameras down and told them to go. And I thought, oh, my Lord, I'm kind of throwing it away. But it didn't matter. These guys are so hot that they just broke through any kind of camera angle we had. I think we shot all this in about an hour and a half. And they're just electric. It burned up the whole floor. Weaker dancers, you know, this would be deadly to photograph them like this in the wide shot. You know, you wouldn't get any electricity, but look at this. I think your DVD may be melting. Check your player. Put your hand right on top of the player. See if it's getting overheated. If it is, then you know, shut it off, let it cool down, and continue with the movie. I also got to direct them in Spanish, which is a lot of fun for me. And they were very tolerant since my Spanish is not that great, but they were, you know, getting a kick out of the fact that I was trying it. I think this may be even me who, with this guy in the white said, Numero uno, that's me. Oh, boy, that's my acting trip for this movie.
They weren't better, they was different, that's all, just different.
Bullshit.
All right, folks, we have decision of the judges. In third place, we have Elizabeth and Joseph Purser.
This is the brother and sister team that I showed you early on, and we gave them a prize because they were just such a wonderful addition and made a featured moment with them.
Thank you.
So it's almost nowhere in the movie is this kind of racism and prejudice exposed as clearly as it is in this moment. And we can see something has happened to Tony Manero's character, that he realizes the falsity of the whole thing, and now how it's totally wrong. Probably because he appreciates the quality of the dancing so much, and he knows that this is just the wrong thing to do. And these guys are all into the neighborhood, and the neighborhood is tops and it's everything, but he knows that he didn't win this contest. He didn't win first prize. Both of the other couples were better than him.
Them down,
don't you did? No difference.
You phony bastards. You know who should have won that contest. My own fucking friends can't even be straight with me. You gotta lie right through your fucking teeth. Come on.
Fuck your ass, man.
Look, we won it.
Stephanie, that was rigged. It's like family. They can't give it to no spick or no stranger. What are you, crazy?
We was just as good as they were, Tony, and I know it.
Oh, you think so, huh?
Yeah.
Come with me. Congratulations.
So, it was a terrific moment when he gives the money and the trophy back to the Puerto Rican couple.
It's a fucking shithole, that a fucking shithole! God damn it, friends, the assholes I hang out with, I can't believe them sometimes,
This is a wonderful rant. He just is allowed to go along, and it's as articulate, as poetic as anything somebody could have written, that was more fancy, but it expresses so clearly the emotions that he's feeling, and it expresses it as only this character could say it.
All right, okay, listen, would you just tell me what's wrong, okay? What is it?
Get in!
Just tell me. The hell is wrong with you? Stop it. Look, just stop it. Let me alone, man.
Not knowing what to do with his anger, he just kind of acts it out, and the only thing he knows to do, which is sexual.
Why are you hanging around with me?
Dancing, that's why.
Oh, dancing, huh?
Yeah.
Why else?
Oh, you want to know? It's bullshit. Yeah. That's why. Bullshit, man. I've just been dumping my bullshit all over you, selling my act on you, using you, making you think that I love you. It's just all bullshit, man.
Fucking cunt. You're fucking...
Stop it. You stop it. Don't.
Oh! Oh, Stephanie. Oh.
You got weight to see
that. Oh.
Yeah. I'm mad at you, Tony.
Hey, Tony, come on. Let's go give everybody a piece of snatch pie.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, the fuck you are. Hey, what are you doing?
The scene we're about to do with the this kind of rape of Annette or a gangbang, which is probably more accurately, it starts as a gangbang and becomes a rape, was something that I was very bothered by in the original script. I just felt very uncomfortable about shooting it, about having it be part of the movie. And I just thought we had gone over the bounds of any kind of good taste here. But Robert Sigwood insisted, and he said it's very key to the theme of the movie, so it became up to me to find ways to get the idea across without really seeing anything going on. And we're really, really lucky to have Donna Pascal here, because she's able to convey so much, and she's so full of emotion, and you feel so bad for her, that even though she went into this a little loaded and for the wrong reason, she's realized that she got herself in way too deep, and it conveys so well with her. And you know, and then play a lot of it on John's face. Let him, you know, he's expressing all of the things that, you know, that are going on and his disgust for being part of this whole world.
Woo! Yeah! Woo! Fuck! Double J! Come on, Double J! Come on! Woo!
Amazing things that you find out that people can do, like Joe Kelly doing a handstand there, and Paul Pape saying, I know what I'll do, I'll come out with my pants down. They knew they were in a totally free situation, and you know, they could express it however they wanted, and it gives it you know, a very vital kind of quality when you let them go at it. Because, you know, if they go over the top, you can always take it out. But if they feel like they're stuck, then they're not going to be free. And that, you know, is a wonderful counterpoint with this scene where these two people just feel horrible.
Where you going?
Next.
We're freezing up here. It's early in March. It was just terrifyingly cold. And when we got there that night, we had to, you know, deal with a problem because this is the scene where Bobby C. falls off the bridge. And we had to do, you know, wide scenes where we could see the people falling. And everybody was concerned that the stuntmen would fall. They'd be walking on beams that were icy and were icing up, and it wouldn't be safe for them to be there. So we wanted to do those shots before we did these close-ups, if I'm making any sense. So quickly, while the actors are getting dressed, I shoot the high falls with the wide shots, and then we go to do this part of it. Then I bring the actors out, and I show them what we've done in the high falls, and say, okay, we're gonna match to this. And John looks at it, and he said, I don't want to do that. And I go, well, we had to do this initially, you know. And the difference was that at this point in the scene that we're at right now, he would have been on his knees because it was so dangerous that he'd get down on his knees, and hopefully he could grab hold of Bobby C. with one hand and not be taken over, because standing up is very dangerous. You can see here's Paul Pape's character, Double J, coming out on his knees. Well, we wanted John to do the same thing. He said, no, I can't. It just looks wimpy to be on your knees. So it got into a bit of a standoff there, and then finally I realized that we were never going to get it shot because John's a very determined person, and once he's made his mind up, that's it. So we had to shoot it the way he wanted to, with him standing up and in the widest of shots. Briefly, you could probably see them both on their knees. The mismatch is still in the film from that widest shot.
Do you guys think maybe he killed himself?
Ways of killing yourself without killing yourself.
There's a lot of shots here, a lot of different angles, a lot of different takes, and all of these actors, especially Donna Pascal, were able to keep that emotion flowing. And, you know, it's tough enough to cry one time on film, but people that can do it take after take after take and bring up that emotion, you have to have such respect for their technique and their ability, and she just could do it every single time.
Tom? Hey, Tony!
Mm-hmm.
this point in movie making, synthesizers were virtually unheard of. So David Shire's synthesized music in this area was really quite special and odd, and would catch your attention. Nowadays, we sort of take that sort of music for granted because almost everything is being synthesized. But as it goes along and then eventually blends into the song that almost never made it into the film. Because we're using this kind of music to represent the state of his mind. But as we're cutting it together, I thought, well, maybe we have one of those Bee Gees songs that we haven't used. Is there anyone left? And the assistant editor looks up and says, well, here's one called How Deep Is Your Love? And I said, oh, I forgot about that one. And we put it on and said, oh, well, this will work. Okay, let's put it here. And it was perfect. And it made me think that even though the Bee Gees said they never read the script, that they knew where things were to go, because they were just logical places that all five of their songs fit, and they didn't seem to fit anywhere else. And this was the first of four number one hits that the album had. The first one that was released, and it went straight to number one, and then was followed by More Than a Woman and Staying Alive, and the other songs.
Is that you?
Yeah, it's me, Stephanie.
Hey, look, I'm really sorry about last night.
You're sorry?
Yeah, I'm sorry, Stephanie. It won't happen again, I promise you. I just really need to talk to you.
What are you talking about? You need to...
One of the guilty pleasures of watching DVDs is you can freeze frame and see all the mistakes that were made in the movie. Shortly, once he comes in the door, you'll probably be able to see the microphone poking in from the top of the frame. That's just one of those tragic, tragic mistakes. But everybody gets a kick out of it, except for me, of course, who had to answer letters for years as to why we allowed microphones to be in.
So that way you don't think that I'm going to, jump you or nothing.
What's wrong with you, man?
Nothing, I'll tell you later, man.
We're gonna just stand here. This is ridiculous. Come on.
Been up all night just walking.
It's in that wider shot. I'm not seeing it right here, but I know it's there. I've seen it before. I had to answer all those letters.
Because I ain't going back.
Wait a minute. Why don't you just sit down, okay? Come on. So what are you doing?
What am I doing? I'm just not going back there. That's all. The asshole's back there. I'm fed up to hear with it. It's
okay.
Bullshit.
Okay, what are you going to do?
What do you do? You come in, you get a job, do what you do. You get a nice apartment.
Okay, what kind of job?
I don't know. What'd you do? You came in, you couldn't do nothing, right?
I could type when I came.
Big deal, I'm an able person. I can do these things.
Yeah, of course you can. Tony.
Another missing shot here, if I could go back. You always pile up these things you'd like to have done, would have been for to see Tony coming out of the subway and to Columbus Circle, which is only a few blocks from where this is being shot, and to have the camera way up high and see this lonely figure standing in the middle of Columbus Circle, his first time in in Manhattan by himself, and he's made this breakthrough and he's kind of here lonely by himself. And so we never did get time to do that, just as we never got time to see the discotheque with all its lights turned on, meaning just the regular overhead incandescent lights that make something that's kind of magical look really clunky and ugly and sad. And I always thought that that would be a good shot to have to contrast at the, you know, at the end of the night when they send everybody home, they turn on the lights and, you know, all the magic instantly goes away and just feels kind of seedy.
The truth?
Yeah.
I don't know. I mean, I could try. That's all I could say, Stephanie. I could try.
I like this scene where the, you know, the two kids are trying to find a way to get to each other, you know, on a different basis, on a friendship basis. And I always had this image here as the last image in the picture of people trying to relate to each other, not as sexual objects, but as friends first. What a concept.
In the morning sun, I feel you touch me in the
morning. There was a lot of pressure on, well, can't we get them in bed? Can't we have them in bed in the end? And this is as far as I would go, is let it be with the two of them kind of just, you know, hugging each other in what looks to me now like a very chaste manner.
Keep me warm in your love, then you softly leave, and it's me you need to show.
What you say over the end credits. The end credits are usually the time when everybody goes out to the parking lot. Francis Ford Coppola's father, who was a composer and who wrote a lot of the music for Apocalypse Now, wrote a book about his as a younger man conducting in pit orchestras for musicals, and the title of his book was Nobody Listens to the Exit Music. And here are all these musicians playing away, playing their heart out, and everybody is walking out to the parking lot. So that's probably the case with end credits. You know, we all feel like we have to see our names up there, but nobody sits around to read them, because what do they care? They didn't come to see who was the person that made the coffee or any of that. I mean, they care about Travolta, and they care about, you know, the other actors, but... For all the rest of us, it makes our mothers feel good, I suppose.